We're going to be in Hebrews chapter 11 tonight and just focusing in on a couple of particular verses. And then, as Graham said, next week we kick off on our summer series. It is good to be together as God's people. And it's good to be together, really, not just because we've decided it's a good idea, but because we've been brought together. We've been brought together by a gospel, you know, some news that we've put our trust in. We've been brought together by a loving God who's actually come to us, flicked the lights on, and revealed to us the truth about the reality of life. And that's a pretty good thing. It's so good to know the truth and to see what the truth is. Our loving God's come to us and he's given us, like Graham was talking about last week, you know, gospel clarity, vision. We can see what the deal is. We can see that we have a God and he's real and he's awesome and he's good. We can see that we're living in his world. He owns it. It all belongs to him. And we can see that we are to live in his world in a way that honors him. That's our task, to walk through our days in a way that actually glorifies the one who put us here. That's our task. And one of the ways of describing our task is to say that we're to follow Christ together. Follow Christ together, which is a wonderful thing, but that is really a challenging thing to do too, isn't it? To follow Christ together, because we're following the most radical one who ever lived. And really, so we're following him and attempting to live a radical life for his sake. You know, Jesus was the one who turned to his followers when there was a huge amount of them, like a whole multitude, and they were getting all excited, and he turned to them and warned them effectively by saying, you do know that if you're going to follow me, here's the deal. You've got to pick up your cross and come with me. That's a radical, costly kind of life to live. You do know that that's what the deal is. And this is it. This is the radical life that we're called to follow Christ and to do it together. And to pick up your cross and to follow, it means many things, doesn't it? It's kind of all the different areas of life. It's going to impact your finances. It's going to impact your time and your energy. It's going to impact your sexuality. It's going to impact all of that following Christ. But one big area that we're going to dig into tonight, one big thing about following Christ and picking up your cross is this one. It means we are to choose to stand with God's people and be mistreated. Choose to stand with God's people and be mistreated. You might think, what? Why on earth? Tim, you're not doing a good job selling this. Jesus is the one who says to us very clearly, hey, they hated me, they're going to hate you. It's part of the deal. We've got to get it, we've got to embrace it and know that it's going to be the case. Now, Christians have lived through different seasons in history, haven't they? As you look back through history, and particularly in different parts of the world, you know, Christians will live through different levels of mistreatment in time. You know, we've kind of emerging out of a period called Christendom, where it's been a pretty easy place to be a Christian for a long time in the West, where Christians are the one who have kind of held the high moral ground, and Christians are the ones who have been respected and appreciated, and, you know, for quite some time, and during those kind of seasons of history, it's relatively easy to be Christian because it's culturally acceptable. It's almost expected that you'd be Christian. And so pretty much everyone will say that they're Christian. But then Christians live through other seasons, and I reckon it's the season we're heading into where things change, and they can change a lot. And all of a sudden, Christians end up being the ones who are misunderstood and despised and even rejected by their culture. Have you noticed the change that's happened in our culture in the last little while? And you don't need to be very old to notice the change, I don't reckon. Even if you're young, just thinking back over the last 10 years, what's happened? But if you're a bit older, what's happened over the last 20 to 30 to 40 years is some pretty radical social change, and it impacts the way our society sees us as Christians. It's gone from Christians being a mainstream type of thing to now to be Christian is to be part of this kind of crazy fringe kind of group. It used to be the case that Christians were considered the friends of society, but now we're kind of drifting towards being enemies. It used to be the case that Christians were viewed as the ones who were kind and gracious and the first to get in there and help vulnerable minority groups. But now, have you noticed, Christians are the ones who are the heartless, hate-filled bigots who are actually causing all the pain to the minority groups. And that's changed quite quickly for us. It's almost as though, as Christians, we used to be the ones hosting the party of society. And now it's become, we're kind of that invited guest. And it's quickly drifting towards Christians being the ones who kind of are the uninvited ones who are kind of crashing the party. That's how our society is changing. We need to notice it. You don't have to look far back in history. That's where things are heading. And if that's the case, if I haven't overstated it, or even if there's any truth to that, if you're a Christian, you're going to find yourself having to make a choice pretty regularly. Are you going to accept the mistreatment and even step into whatever's coming for Christians? Or will you attempt to distance yourself from the mistreatment that God's people are copping? Had a chat with a fella in the Forreys car park recently who I just know from the surf, and, you know, leading up to Christmas, just, you know, doing the chit-chat, what do you got planned for Christmas thing? And I thought, oh, come on, Tim, go there. So I said to him, I won't give you his name, let's call him Frank. Frank, hey, come to church, mate. Why don't you come to church for Christmas? And he just kind of rolled his eyes at me. He said, church, mate, you'll never get me in church. And then I said, why? And he goes, oh, well, this and that and this and that. And then I go, yeah, but why? Like, seriously, why wouldn't you? I kept pressing him. And then he ended up kind of telling me. It was pretty full on. And he told me what he really thought of Christians. And he told me about some of his, kind of alluded to some of his experiences, painful experiences with Christians. And then really he kind of launched into like what's been happening over the last 5 to 10 years and what he thinks of Christians and the way they're so judgmental and they're so bigoted and they're so filled with hatred. So he's doing this, right? Now, what do you think's going through my head? Because I'm just like you, right? What's going through my head is this. Oh, how am I going to be able to convince him that I'm not like one of those people that he's talking about, right? I'm thinking, how can I distance myself from this? But I end up going, as I'm listening to what he's saying, I'm thinking, no, actually, that is me that he's talking about. He's just describing how the beliefs of mainstream Orthodox Christianity are actually really painful to be heard by other certain groups. And he was, you know, and I kind of thought, I'm gonna say it. And I'm really proud of myself for what I said because I don't always do this. Sometimes, and most of the times I feel like I, you know, stuff it and back down and afterwards find myself going, geez, if I could only have that conversation again. Do you do that all the time? Anyway, I didn't in this moment. I kind of said, well, I'll share with you what I said, right? I said to him, what are we calling him? Frank. I said, Frank, he's going to town on Christians, right? I said, Frank, you're talking about my people. I kind of said it like a black person, right? No, I didn't. It just kind of came out like that then. It's all about my people. Sorry, that's probably not a good thing to say. It's not even the notes, right? And by that, I'm saying, you're talking about me here. And he goes, yeah, man, if you're going to, he said something like, if you're going to kind of put yourself in that group, then yeah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, okay, righto. Gave me a little bit more, and then he hopped in his car and drove off. Now, do you find yourself in those kind of situations? Because if you haven't much, you probably need to open your mouth and share who you really are a little bit more, and you'll find yourself in those kind of situations. Here's the thing, though. We are not the first generation of Christians to experience this type of challenge, and it's just beginning to come for us. I actually think if this is the season we're heading into, one of the best things we can do is to look back through history at how our brothers and sisters have conducted themselves through far more challenging times than we're going through. But we need to look back and spot the men and women who have lived by faith and be encouraged by watching them live. We need to read biography of people who have gone before us. I bought Corrie Ten Boom for my daughter the other day. I thought, you got to read that, you know. Graham's always carrying on about this guy named John Patton, who was the missionary who went to Vanuatu. We read that off the back of our trip. Do you read Christian biography? of the men and women who have gone before us and sacrificed so much to stand for Christ and stand with these people and pass the gospel on to you so you could know forgiveness and mercy. Do you know what's gone before you? Because, guys, this is our moment. This is our season to walk faithfully, to walk with guts, because the people in the future are dependent on us walking by faith with the gospel. And in 50, 100, 200 years' time, when they look back at our season, what are they going to be saying about the way we've lived? But in this moment right now, what I want us to do is look back, and I want us to attempt to get some encouragement by people who have gone before us. And one of the ways of doing that is to turn open to chapter 11 of Hebrews. Am I right? This is like the Hall of Fame, a list of the Hall of Fame of faithful men and women of the Bible, or just some of them. And a little bit of detail about them. This list, if you've never, you know, spent some time in Hebrews chapter 11, are a list of men and women who've walked in such courageous ways for the Lord that we read there in verse 38 that the world was not worthy of them. Imagine living the kind of life where people in the future look back at the way you lived and just say, man, the world was not worthy of that soul. That is serious living for Christ. We're going to zoom in and focus in on one particular character at the beginning of the Bible passage we had read there, Moses. That's who we're going to look at. And really, we're just going to look at verses 24 through to 27 and a bit of detail on how his life is reflected on. Come with me, be inspired and encouraged with me by seeing how one of our brothers lived a courageous life of faith. Look at verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he'd grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. It kicks off here in verse 24, looking at Moses. And you, even if you're completely unfamiliar with the Bible, you'll know of the character Moses, right? Maybe you've watched Prince of Egypt. As an older man after this, Moses was the guy who led his people, the Israelites, out of slavery in Egypt. And they went for like this 40-year walk around the desert because they kept stuffing up. But basically during that time, there were a couple of key stopovers. The first one was the key one where Moses led the people to Mount Sinai, where Moses went up on the mountain, met with God and received from God commands for his people about how they were to live. A summary of those commands, the Ten Commandments, were given to Moses on stone tablets. Have you got that picture now? That dude with the beard and the hair walking down the mountain with stone tablets? That's Moses. But his life began in a pretty remarkable way as well, a pretty miraculous way. It's kind of referred to back there in verse 23, the verse before we read. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw that he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So at the beginning of Moses' life, the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, gave an edict which was basically to try to stop these Hebrews multiplying anymore, and the way to do that was to murder every newborn male that was born. It's horrific. It's unimaginable horror what would have been going on in this place. The babies were instructed to be murdered and drowned in the River Nile and sent down that way. And that's the River Nile would have just been littered with baby boys for months and then maybe even years. It would have been absolutely horrific. Moses' parents don't care. They're going to keep their kid alive. So they hide him for 3 months. But then they do end up chucking him in the Nile River. But they chuck him in a basket that he can survive in, an ark. And that little basket floats providentially and to the feet of the daughter of Pharaoh, who's down by the Nile River bathing. And as the basket comes to her, she opens it, sees it's a Hebrew baby, knows what's meant to be happening here, but God gives her compassion and she's sad and she takes the child as her own and decides she's going to raise this little Hebrew boy in the royal palace and give him all the privileges of being part of the royal family himself. So that's a miraculous start for a little Hebrew boy in that time. He wouldn't have had many boys that were growing up his age group because they all were murdered. But here's how his life begins. As Moses grows up, it begins in verse 24 there, when he had grown up, he's probably kind of 40 years old, so almost grown up, right? He finds himself needing to, he finds himself making a pretty big decision or a couple of big decisions. He chooses a line of conduct that he knows is going to mean mistreatment for him. Moses is not kind of, it's not thrust upon him. He steps deliberately into this life. Now, we don't get all the details of that. When you go back to Exodus 2 and you're like, well, hang on, when did Moses do all this? We don't get the details, but we do get references to how he goes out every day to his people and he watches them and he tries to protect them. And I think they're just little references into the world that Moses had been in for quite some time. It'd be great to have more detail on it, but here's the summary. Moses makes a big decision. He decides to give up position, pleasure, and treasure, and take on suffering and scorn. And it's pretty crazy. Just think with me about the details of what Moses gave up here. He gives up position, right? He's the son of Pharaoh's daughter, which means most people say that he's like the prince of Egypt. And most people think he was even in first in line for the throne. So he could have become Pharaoh himself. That's serious position and rank. That's a real serious somebody to be. Title, honor, power, known, respected. All the kind of things that most mere mortals like us kind of struggle for our whole lives to gain a little bit of. To be a somebody. To be a little bit known. To be maybe looked up to a little bit. Moses has got all of that. And he turns his back on it, and rather he decides to become a nobody with God's people. He decides to be looked down upon. He wants to be ignored and mocked and laughed at, and he does it by choice. It's huge. So he gives up position. He gives up pleasure. You can see that in verse 25. He chose to be mistreated along with God's people rather than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. One thing to notice here about sin is it's pleasurable, usually, for a fleeting moment. And all this is right in front of Moses, you know, every earthly pleasure at his beck and call, all intellectual pleasures, all the arts and the sciences, all social pleasures he would have had anyone at his disposal, all the sensual pleasures, the lusts of the flesh, the pleasures of sin, all the kind of things that most people long for. We try and find pleasure in so many different areas. We hunt for it. We hunt for it in travel or in entertainment or in sexual expression or in substances. But here's Moses and he's got every pleasure at his fingertips and he turns his back on it. He refuses it. He gives it up and instead he chooses the opposite of pleasure. He chooses torment, mistreatment, tears, pain, distress, abuse, suffering, with his people. He chooses disgrace. And he chooses disgrace for the sake of Christ. Now, quick little pause here. That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? Moses, who lives 1,500 years-ish before Jesus, chooses disgrace for the sake of Jesus, but Jesus hasn't even come yet. You see what's interesting there? What's going on there? Well, the writer of Hebrews here is kind of almost importing ultimate meaning back into that Old Testament event for Moses. And I think by doing that, he's kind of helping us to see that all of the sufferings of Moses and all of the sufferings of God's people really were looking forward to a particular moment of suffering. They were anticipating the ultimate moment of suffering, and that is Christ's suffering where he goes to the cross. And all of that kind of suffering was pointing forward to this moment, the moment where salvation would come for God's people. So there's a sense in which, even though Moses didn't know that explicitly, his suffering was part of God's plan to bring about salvation. What a wonderful thing to be said about his suffering. He gives up position, pleasure, treasure. You know, verse 26, he regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as greater value than the treasures of Egypt. The treasures of Egypt are something quite phenomenal. I mean, you just got to look at the structures that are still standing in Egypt today to kind of get a glimpse of the kind of place that was. Unimaginable wealth. And it could all have been his. He turns his back on it. He gives it up. He walks away from the approval of the king. He leaves Egypt and embraces citizenship among God's people and is hated and mocked and persecuted with them, experiencing poverty and anxiety and distress with them. It just sounds crazy, doesn't it? I mean, who does that? And why would you ever do that? And note this one as well. We're not talking about a young punk is just trying to be radical and make crazy decisions so he's cool and gets attention from everyone else, right? That's not what's going on. And you're not talking about some old fella who's about to fall off the perch and so he's got to give it all up anyway. You're talking about a guy who's like probably a 40-year-old man in the prime of his life, right? Highly educated, well thought through, deliberate. Ditches all the things we typically live for and takes on all the things we typically avoid. Either this is one of the greatest sacrifices mortal man has ever made, or this is one of the greatest midlife crises you've ever seen. And the way you figure out what it is actually seeing clearly why he does this. And it's way more than a midlife crisis. But it can be summed up in just one word. Why does he do this? Faith. Faith. Like real, legitimate, genuine faith drove these decisions. Moses is given what you might call eyes of faith. Eyes of faith that enable him to let go of much that's right in front of him in order to take hold of what is far better ahead of him. It's like he's given eyes to see beyond what's right there, visible, physical, in front of him. He sees something that's far, far greater. So he gives up pleasure and position and treasure and acceptance. And I reckon here's how you can describe what he sees. Moses gets the eyes of faith and he effectively says this: I see my God, I see my people, and I see my home. There's my summary of what it is to have the eyes of faith. You get to see things that are beyond the physical realms of this world. Far better, far bigger, far realer. Moses says, I see my God, my people, my home. Let's look at those three things. I see, I reckon Moses says, my God. Look at verse 27. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered, look at this one, because he saw him who is invisible. So Moses does this because he sees him who is invisible. That's God who is invisible to physical sight until he comes in the person of Jesus and lives in history. God is invisible, but Moses sees him. That's what the eyes of faith can enable you to do. You can see God. You can find yourself being able to say, I can see that he's real and that he's true and that these are his words and that they are to be followed. And even if God and what he says to me here in this world really goes against the culture that I'm living in and I feel like I'm swimming upstream the whole time, I believe this to be real because I can see that it is. Eyes of faith help me see God is real. Eyes of faith help you see that God is powerful and holy and perfect, so that he actually is the one who will judge all people. And as we looked at last week, Psalm chapter 2, God as the judge will smash his opponents and his enemies in the end. Now, that's an important thing to see. I can see that is who my God is. I can see with the eyes of faith that not only those things, but also this one, I can see that God is also loving and merciful and gracious, and has come for me and a broken world with Jesus to offer forgiveness. And you can only see that with the eyes of faith. Now, when I say eyes of faith, don't confuse that with blind faith, as though there's literally no tangible, physical, historical evidence at all out there to support any of this. That's not the case. especially when you look at the reality of the historical man, Jesus. I mean, the historical evidence for Jesus' life and death and resurrection is so overwhelming, you've got to be really covering your eyes up to actually not see that he's real and at least consider what he says about himself. So to have the eyes of faith is not blind faith, but I do want to ask you this. Can you see? Can you see your God? Can you see that he's real and true and holy and perfect and loving and merciful? Many of you can, I know. You know it's true. It's like the lights have come on for you. You've been given the eyes of faith. And if that's you, be grateful. You've been given those eyes. If that's not you, ask for eyes of faith. Ask that you would see that this is true. And at the same time, go out and check out all the historical evidence for this. If there is a God and he really has interacted with humanity through history, there ought to be evidence. Real, tangible, historical evidence in their ears. You can get out there and hunt that down. But at the same time, ask God to give you faith to see that he's real. Moses, with the eyes of faith, says, I see my God and I see my people. My people. I reckon that's what's going on for Moses here from a young age, even though he's growing up in the palace and would have been so easily distracted by all the wonderful things all around him. There's evidence that he's just continually drawn to these slaves that are out there banging bricks up every day and being mistreated. And he's drawn to them. He knows he's one of them and he keeps going out to them and he sees that they're his people and that he belongs to them. Moses sees something about the Hebrews, God's people. He sees the reality of the true value of belonging to God's people. And he sees that the value of being part of God's people is greater than any other treasure on earth. And so he says, I'm with them, even though that means mistreatment. That's better. Can you see what Moses saw in God's people? Do you look at Christians, the church, and just go, my people? And there's something real and deep going on for you. Do you have the eyes of faith that help you see your people, your family? Because I reckon what Moses saw, and I tell you what the Bible continually tells us about this, is you see that God's people are precious, and they're precious to him. Can you look at God's people, the church, and see that they are the ones who are loved by God in a particular way, meaning that they're redeemed and brought back to him? Can you see that God's people are the ones who he calls his own and he gives us his name and tells us we have an inheritance coming for us? Can you see how God's people are at the very center of his heart and his focus and his desire? Can you see that God's people are the ones who God pours out his affection upon? Can you see your people? Can you see that God's people are the ones who get his favor and his acceptance? Can you see your people that they are an everlasting family? Can you see them? I totally remember the season in my life where God showed me a whole bunch of real things about the reality of his people. It was a huge point for me, and it turned things around. It was about 25 years ago. I was about 4 years old. I was about 20, so you could probably figure out how old I am, if you're really clever. I'd been living for having grown up in the church and been taught to love Jesus from an early age and seen it in my family and in the people around me. To my shame, I actually spent many of my years pretty embarrassed to belong to God's people. Kind of, I used to do everything I could to kind of avoid association with them. I was kind of ashamed to belong. I was frustrated by their weirdness and their quirkiness, and still am sometimes. And there was a group of people in my local church, you know, kind of crew my age, who used to hang out on Saturday nights. And yeah, I just I just didn't want anything to do with them. They'd hang out. They'd stand around a fire bin. They'd pray for people like me. They'd sing, like with guitars and stuff, like full on. They'd open Bibles and have Bible studies. And then sometimes they'd even go out and try and talk to people about Jesus. Everything about that freaked me out. Until God did this huge work in my heart, and I'm this guy kind of walking away from the fold of God, like that song we sing. Oh, I can't sing that line, I break down, wandering far from the fold of God. It's like through a bunch of different circumstances, God gets a hold of me. It's like he grabs me by my shoulders. I got my back to his people. I'm going somewhere else. He grabs me by the shoulders and he just graciously, through some hectic scenarios, which were very painful but beautiful, just goes like this and he turns me around and he points me towards his people and he shows me some stuff. And, some things broke inside of me and some other things came alive inside of me, but basically it's just God, by the powerful work of his Spirit, showing me the reality of his people. And then all of a sudden I'm as surprised as anyone to be all of a sudden changing my attitude and my feelings and my desires towards this mob that I always wanted to run away from. And I found myself actually wanting to know them and wanting to hang out with them and wanting to do the things they did, and actually learning to really love them and appreciate them. And I've got to tell you, I was shocked. My mates who I'd spent more time over the years partying with, they were pretty shocked. But in the end, I just desperately wanted them to see what I'd seen, so I spent ages trying to get them to come and see it. And then one night, I remember getting them all to come along. It was hanging out at someone's house, and I'd been telling these mates that I want you to meet these mates because they're awesome, and these mates pray for. I was trying to bring it all together. I remember bringing a couple of my key mates from school to come along, and then I got them in the door. I just really wanted them to see, And I remember walking around, introducing them to this weirdo and then that weirdo and all me new weird friends, right? Who I was just fully excited and loving because I could see with the eyes of faith something absolutely beautiful going on here. And I'm introducing them, I'm trying to make it work, and I'm thinking it's not really working, they're not really into it. And then later on the night I kind of found out, yeah, they weren't, they really heaps weren't into it. And effectively end up saying to me, dude, it's either us or them, you make the call, and then there's that decision. What am I going to do? Am I going to actually really commit to this mob and actually be mistreated and rejected? Am I going to try to live with a foot in both worlds and do the really awkward splits that God hates his people when they do the splits, And I'm so glad that I really made quite a tangible decision in my mind. Now, I'm with these guys. I'm going to choose the people of God. And I got to say, I've never regretted that decision. Never regretted that decision. And check it out. Here I am, 25 years later, still hanging out with a bunch of weirdos on a Saturday night. Hey? But I love you, all right? And I feel like sometimes you love me too. But God's doing something bigger with us. Yeah, it's amazing. Moses could see his people. Can you see your people? Can you see who they are? Can you see how precious they are to God? Can you see that though there's dysfunction and though there's foibles and though there's all kinds of stuff that goes on sometimes, these are the ones who in the end get everything. These are the ones who inherit everything. Because that's the third point. Moses, with the eyes of faith, saw my God, my people, and my home, and the inheritance and the reward that was coming in the future. He sees with the eyes of faith. Have a look at it, verse 26. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater worth than the treasures of Egypt. Look at this. Because, see that word because? Here it is. Here's the reason. Because he was looking ahead to his reward. So he's prepared to miss out here and suffer disgrace here because he's looking ahead to his reward. With the eyes of faith, he's able to sacrifice much because he's confident and he's got an assurance in the promises of God about the world to come, his reward in heaven. And he knows that to be with these people means to be with the mob who, in the end, get everything. Like the firstborn child, that's how Israel's described in the Old Testament, you get everything. Ultimate reward in the heavenly home. So to live with the eyes of faith and actually see your home and your inheritance that is to come, your permanent eternal place, is to kind of live with your eyes fixed on the future. So you don't get so stuck on what presents right in front of your face. But it's almost like you're living with a telescope strapped to your face that forces you to look into the distant future and you actually can't see what's right in front of you. It's kind of a bit scary. But it takes your focus off everything in the here and now. Not that we aren't to focus and function in the here and now, but we're to have our eyes fixed on our heavenly reward. And I tell you what, those who follow the epic way of the ancients who have gone before us are those who have lived by faith, not sight. They've looked into the future and seen the reality of that and had confidence in that, not just looked with their physical eyes at the things right in front of them. And I'll tell you what, only faith is going to enable you to choose God and his people before the world. Only faith will enable you to see that the promises of heaven that are out of sight are better than things on earth right in front of your face. It's only with the eyes of faith that you'll be able to see that tomorrow's gains are better than today's losses. It's only with faith that you'll be able to see that our invisible God is better than anything you can see. And it's only the eyes of faith that will enable you to see that his praise and his acceptance is better than any praise and acceptance you get in this world. A couple of practicals to kind of finish on here. What does it mean for us to live with the eyes of faith? How do you go after the eyes of faith? Well, I'll tell you what, it's got to begin here, hasn't it, with this one? You've got to pray for faith. And if you've got it, pray for an increase in faith. Pray, Lord, help me see. Help me see you. Help me see your people. Help me see my home. There's the first big one. And we'll finish by praying that in just a minute. But it may be that you've never felt like you've ever had faith. You might be needing to pray that for the very first time. Do it. Pray for faith. Here's the second one. In regards to church, God's people, stop dabbling and dive in. Because you can spend years and years dabbling around the edges, fluffing on the fringe. But dive in. Don't flirt with the church. Marry God's people. Like, give yourself wholeheartedly to his people, to him and his people. Jump in there. To do that means deciding, literally, tangibly, for 2018, it means deciding what you're not going to do, what you're going to give up in 2018, to create some space and free up some of your time and energy for more serious commitment to God's people. But give some stuff up. Give up what's needed, you need to give up in order to more seriously commit. And just take the next step, whatever that is for you. Everyone's in different places. What's the next step for you towards more serious commitment to his people? To really dive in. For some of you, it may just be starting with, well, all right, I'm just going to get to the gathering. I'm just going to get here, and I'm going to get here every week. And I'm going to make sure nothing gets in the way of me gathering with God's people, because I'm going to stand with them, and I'm going to be with them. And maybe that's for you. Maybe others of you are like, well, I'm just going to actually finally or more fully get in a group, a Bible study group, and I'm going to commit to actually reading the Bible and praying with my brothers and sisters midweek and learning how to try to love them and live with them. For some of you, it's going to be like, well, I just actually need to step up properly and serve and, you know, give up some serious time and commit to actually being on a team and doing this and that. For others of you, it might be this, it might be money. Which apparently is often the last thing in a Christian life to be converted. You know, the wallet, it's the final thing to get converted. Maybe 2018, maybe this is the year for you to actually more seriously dive into God's people, is to do it with your finances. and seriously commit to being in this with us with all of the resources that God's given you. And sacrifice seriously and regularly for the sake of the gospel in this place and beyond. Maybe that's the big step for you this year. And others of you are like, oh, no, we already give regularly and all that. Well, I don't know, is it painful what you give? Because to stand with God's people is to kind of step toward this hardship. It is to be sacrificial. So maybe you need to sit and have a think about it again. Maybe that's the step for you. The eyes of faith, 2018, leave Pharaoh's daughter, join the bride of God. Now, some of that you may, some of you go, I got all that sorted. All right, I got some more for you. Two more things. The eyes of faith ought to, you want to put them on and run this way. You run from the pleasure of sin. Understanding sin is sweet for a season, but you need to run from sin. So to repent of sin and to turn your back on it means turning your back on the pleasure that sin brings for a fleeting moment. So to run from sin actually means to run from a level of pleasure that sin brings. So don't be surprised if you turn your back on sin, you'll be like, oh, wow, a bunch of my pleasure just disappeared. Yep. Flee from the pleasure of sin in order to take on real, deep, lasting pleasure and joy for eternity. Run from the pleasure of sin. Here's the final one. And here's the one that as it comes out of my mouth, I'm just wondering how you'll go with this one because I'm wondering how I'm going with it. Step toward mistreatment. Step toward mistreatment. It sounds counterintuitive. Who does that? Who wants to step towards suffering? But here's the thing. To seriously be sharing Jesus with our people in our community, I think we need to understand it means stepping towards mistreatment. I think it means coming out. I know that phrase has been used for a particular group of people for many years, but I think it's probably time for Christians to start to learn how to come out. And maybe there's a particular group of people in your life where you haven't come out to them yet and said, yeah, I'm a Christian. And yeah, I belong to those people. Yep, I'm part of the church. Do you need to come out? Do you need to actually learn to stand for the truth? Do you need to actually open your mouth? And actually, there needs to be an end to the silence for you in some sector of your life where you've just been all zipped up because you're trying to maintain the peace and you're not wanting people to walk away from you. So maybe here's my challenge for you this week in that regard, if that's you. I want to hear of somebody who's come out this week and owned up to their friends or their family or someone, yeah, I'm a Christian, and cop some flack for it. Can someone tell me that you've done that this week somewhere? Can someone just text me and say, yeah, I did it and copped it? It would just be a great encouragement to me, okay? Because I actually think that's what we need to encourage each other with. It's going to come for us. This is the new season we're moving into. Step away from cheap Christianity. The kind of Christianity that costs very little, requires no sacrifice, offends nobody, and is basically worth very little to you anyway. Step away from cheap Christianity and step toward cross-shaped Christianity, where you embrace making sacrifices. You make the choices Moses made because salvation is so dear to you. You live in a way that causes there to be jarring and collision with people around you who are more earthly minded. And they think you're a fool. They think you make stupid decisions. But if there's no cross, there's no crown. This is what it means to follow Jesus. When was the last time someone said to you, you are missing training for Bible study? Or you're leaving this party early, or you're leaving holidays early to get to church? Or you're giving how much of your money to them? Or you're using a whole week of your annual leave for Summerfest or some other churchy church thing? Is anybody thinking you're nuts? Because if no one's thinking you're nuts, you're probably living in cheap Christianity land. Step away from it. Step towards the cost. And like many who have gone before us and lived by faith so courageously, we will get to together rejoice to be counted worthy of suffering for the name of Jesus. Let me pray. Father God, we desperately need your help in this. You've brought us into your people. How wonderful. But Father, we need the eyes of faith to walk like countless brothers and sisters have walked in the past. Please help us. Please work in us. Please do that work of your Holy Spirit that only you can do to help us see you, your people, and our home. Please do that work, Lord. Amen.